This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
April 2016, our economy added 160,000 new jobs. That makes April the 74th consecutive month of private sector job growth in America.
Not very good job numbers, and I pose the question, are we spiraling down towards recession?
This number was dismal, and for all of those half-witted economists that believe that the jobs number has been the greatest support for the so-called recovery, they have to think again.
The global economy is not growing as fast as it should be.
What are you doing? You can't outrun the bear. I don't have to outrun the bear. I only have to outrun you. We're better than Europe, so we don't need to outrun the bear. We just need to outrun Europe, or we need to outrun negative growth, but we need to outrun Japan.
Well, a bit of bad news on the economy on Friday, not something the White House is really pleased about. Job numbers and job creation fell to 160,000 last month, and previous month job creation numbers were revised lower. Well, the market seemed to like that on Friday, figuring if the job market is weakening, well, maybe Yellen doesn't go in June, as some are anticipating. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in hour one, Tom McClellan will be joining us. And wait till you hear what he has to say about that old cliche, sell in May, go away. You're going to want to hear what Tom has to say about that, especially what he thinks about gold, even though it's going up at the moment. Robert Rapier will be joining me later on in the first hour as we talk about the energy market. He sees it coming into balance, hitting closer to between 50 and 60 towards the end of the year. You want to hear why he feels that way. I threw some hardball questions at him as to what all these inventory numbers would mean and when that would put a damper on oil, but you'll want to listen to what he has to say. And Ryan Poplava will be here talking about what moved the markets this week.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, the numbers don't look good at all. Economic numbers were released last Friday. Second quarter of last year, the economy grew 3.9%. That dropped to below 2% in the third quarter of last year, down below 1.4% in the fourth quarter, and dropped 0.5% in the first quarter of this year. The real question is right now, is the economy approaching some kind of a stalling speed? Has the economy actually peaked out? And then what will the trends do as they take us in different directions? So we'll spend a lot of time looking at the things, the emotional, the psychology, things affecting how people are investing and how they're feeling. Speaking of feeling, as Jim mentioned, the job numbers were not looking at all very well. On Friday, President Obama took to the microphone to try to explain away why. But the real question is, what does that mean? Because, well, people are feeling also the large amount of debt. Is that what's killing us right now? There's a huge amount of corporate, personal, global debt, as well as our own national debt, which is now approaching $20 trillion. You can't spend more because you don't have more to spend in order to stimulate the economy. We'll consider all of those things today on The Big Picture right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And as always here on the program, our first check is with Ryan Poplava to see what the catalysts and the drivers that move the market this week. And, well, I don't know how it went this week, but there seems to be a buzz. There seems to be more optimism in the market, despite some of the numbers out there. Maybe we'll get to that later here. So what do you see?
Yeah, I've definitely heard that in from some of the central bankers, you know, like the Fed presidents. They've been commenting quite a bit over the last few weeks. And I've heard a lot more optimism, I'd have to agree. But, you know, there really wasn't, I would think, any kind of catalyst, really big ones this week. Unlike last week, we had the Bank of Japan meeting, which I felt was like a pretty big catalyst. They didn't do anything when we had expected that they would. The market adjusted. But nothing like, I guess, those comments from Carl Icahn, right? That moved the market decently. But, you know, I think we're dealing with mostly this week economic announcements, positioning, obviously with valuations fairly high, given the rally that we've had, things needed to cool off a little bit. So we've had the market down just a little bit. I think last I looked at it, we were down like 0.5% from last week. But I also think that, you know, a lot of that is also some technical influences. You know, we're dealing with some pretty decent resistance levels for stocks here in the U.S. I think we're going to continue to deal with those types of influences, the technicals and the economic announcements, until we get closer towards, I think, you know, the June FOMC meeting, when, you know, there's going to be some speculation every announcement we got. Oh, are they going to raise in June? Or are they not? You know, we're going to have to deal with that, I think. And the market will kind of have to digest a lot of that news. But, you know, stocks have come for sale, like I said, this week, and there's been some profit taking, but it's been fairly calm, John, and really absent the kind of panicking selling we had in January and August of last year, when we definitely saw some financial stress indexes go up. There were some concerns, credit default swaps on bonds were going up. But, you know, most of the issues then were surrounding China's currency fixes. And, you know, was China heading towards a hard landing? This week, you know, we did see some weak Chinese economic data points over the last weekend and early this week. You know, China, they don't report the mid-month purchasing managers index data anymore. They just do it at the end of the month. So we got to see what April looked like for China. It was down, I think, for the manufacturing PMI. It was down from, let's see, 50.2 to 50.1. 50 means it's flat, you know, no expansion, no contraction. So we're basically there. Their services PMI, that dropped from 53.8 to 53.5. So not a lot of big movement there. And likewise, not enough to really go and cause a panic over.
Well, you mentioned Carl Icahn. You know, we haven't heard much news regarding China other than what Carl Icahn has been saying.
Yeah. And, you know, Tim Cook recently had a lot of good things to say about China and growth. He had an interview directly, I think, influenced partially by Icahn's comments about his company and Apple. And regarding China, he was talking about year-over-year growth there that was just something like 75% over the past 2 years or something along those lines. So definitely substantial, and sounds like he doesn't sound worried at all. But, you know, I saw a report recently on Business Insider that showed bank credit has been accelerating to almost bubble levels. I looked and it said something about a year-over-year increase in bank credit of around 25%, and that was as of March. And that seems to kind of corroborate, you know, Soros's recent comments about China's financial system, which he said resembles what happened during the financial crisis here in the U.S. in 2007, when credit really kind of bubbled. And that was an article that was written just last month. So any of our listeners, if they wanted to find out more, they could easily Google Soros, Bloomberg, China, and find something there. So that money being created is definitely needed, he said, to keep bad debts and loss-making enterprises alive. So he doesn't have a lot of very positive things to say about China. Felix Zuloff is another one of those, you know, FS Insider guests that we have that has found similar findings and is very worried about China, and has been for some time. Is China still a concern? I think so, but it definitely has been off the radar for investors here in the last few months. That hasn't really seemed to influence it all that much.
Well, if we come back to the U.S., jobs report on Friday wasn't anything to be really thrilled about. As a matter of fact, Jim and I are going to be discussing that on the big picture today as to whether or not the whole economy is hanging on the edge of stalling speed right now. But are we really worried that growth is slowing, or do we worry about labor inflation yet when it comes to the Fed? Which way?
That's the question right there. You really hit it on the nail, John. Which way do we lean? Really hard to lean in any one of those directions. We do have supportive economic indicators for both sides. You know, the jobs report in the U.S., probably the most influential release this week. More specifically, I'll just kind of gloss over it since you guys are going to go into it in more detail. Increased by 160,000 versus the 12-month average I have here is around 232,000. So very subpar and very sub-average. Unemployment rate left the same at 5%. There was an increase, however, you're talking about labor inflation. There was an increase in the hourly earnings. I think it was 0.8%. And the year-over-year change is about 2.5%. That's a fairly decent increase. And you know, anything tied to inflation, John, like labor costs and the CPI, the consumer price index, will have an influence on discussions surrounding a possible rate hike in June for the FOMC. We'll get the producer's price index next Friday and import and export prices next Thursday. So that will definitely be a part of the discussion as we near closer towards a possible rate hike. They estimated last quarter in March that they're going to see two more rate hikes this year. So there's a lot of bets that we're going to see something like maybe June, maybe something like December. We'll see. It's really amazing, though, when I hear interviews or I read about what some of these FOMC regional presidents are saying for the Fed, they've mostly glossed over that low GDP print we got just last week, expecting essentially that, you know, look forward, we're going to have a better quarter next half. At this point in the year, everyone I know as an economist is always saying, second half will be better. Second half will be better. We'll see. It wasn't last year. And they have said that, you know, the weaker dollar should help those multinationals. It should help commodities, help energy producers. And the dollar, John, definitely has weakened. But it was up recently 4 days in a row this week, bouncing off some very, very key support that I believe I mentioned last week as a possibility. So I don't know. I'm fairly confident that I would say from here this month, probably technicals will probably play a very large role in the positioning in the market as, you know, the earnings season is dying down here, quieting. And I don't expect really to see any central bank decisions anytime soon. So ISM services this week, if we look towards economics news and technicals, showed a very big uptick. But then manufacturing, you know, appears to be kind of rolling over. But, you know, back to the jobs report, if you want to take a bullish view, that hourly increase in earnings should help consumption, right?
Okay, well, what do you think about that? I mean, how is retail doing?
It's funny. My brother and I were really talking about that, kind of going back and forth early this week. We were looking at same store sales, trying to get an idea, looking at the whole sector itself, looking at how stocks are performing. Recently, some same store sales were reported for like L Brands, Costco, Zumiez, Fred's and Cato, and it looks like nobody was really guiding higher. And it looks like they were coming in with actual results that were below estimates. So most of those stocks didn't fare very well once those results were given. But, you know, I paired that with the interesting trade deficit data that came in this week. And it showed that the gap narrowed quite sharply. And that wasn't because oil imports were down. Imports as a whole were down 8.1 billion. While exports were down about $1.5 billion. So imports drastically dropped, narrowing that deficit, probably helping the dollar, right, too. And of the $8 billion that dropped in imports, about 5.1 was in consumer goods. So we're not dealing with an energy story here like we were last year. You know, last week, also, I was looking at an article that was run by Fortune, which talked about a lot of department stores closing. They were talking about some research report that suggested if we wanted to get to store sales per square foot at the levels that we saw back in 2006, there'd have to be a lot of store closings to get there. Whether that's going to happen, I don't know, but I have heard there were some store closing announcements made this week. I think Sears and a couple of others had announced some more. But, you know, the competition, John, is just fierce versus the internet retailer. That continues to be, I think, just a huge macro trend. And not only just that of Amazon, but also of special retailers online. And another thing we saw is that mall traffic continues to drop. So it definitely has been a difficult landscape for, you know, the brick and mortar. And that's been that way for, what, 16, 20 years?
Yeah, so it would seem. Anything else you see on the horizon? I'm just trying to forecast out there what's going on.
Like I said, there really, I don't see a lot of very big macro events. There were some, if we want to talk about the Brexit, British exit of the euro, that is a topic that even the FOMC is starting to talk about. Some of the presidents are saying that that might be a reason why they don't do anything in June. And there was some voting for some of the local seats, et cetera, that happened this week. And it looks like, you know, if we're looking at a very outspoken revolution or movement here, it seemed like it was mostly status quo, not a lot of pro Brexit type of parties were being voted in. So, you know, we'll see. That could be a topic down the road. But no, I think technicals this summer will be very significant. So will valuations. We continue to look at earnings, which, you know, earnings growth has just not been there. That's a concern of ours. So, you know, until we get more convincing economic information or more certain direction from, I think, central banks about what the plan is, I think it's time to be cautious. And I've said that for a while here for about a month. So, you know, so far, the market seems to be fairly resilient to any of those concerns over valuations, which was kind of amazing to me this week. We only dropped, like I said, about 0.5%. That's not a lot. And the other thing, too, I continue to watch is the volatility index. Volatility index kind of measures how much risk investors are pricing in the market, how much they're trying to hedge, et cetera. And that remains low for now. And, you know, at the same time, I did read a Bloomberg article that basically stated there's been some increased outflows in junk bond ETFs like HYG, that's iShares, that's BlackRock's junk bond ETF. Noticed a very large increase. And not only that, shorts are increasing in that area. So that was an area, like I said, I think last week, we've been playing in that area. We've been investing in that area individually for individual bonds, especially on the material side and the commodity related side back in January, February. That did well for us. But definitely some concerns here with those types of outflows come from that area. Junk bonds fell considerably during those last two risk periods in August and January. So I definitely think investors need to keep an eye there.
And speaking of shorts, time to get out your shorts for summertime, almost here.
It is.
Yeah.
And maybe for you, I hear a lot hotter over there than over here in San Diego.
Yeah, sort of an invert, isn't it? It's been raining in the Southland there, and we have nice warm weather here in the Pacific Northwest. So it's interesting. Okay, Ryan Poplava, never dull moment here on the Financial Sense News Hour, but that's what we're all about. Hope to see you again next week.
Sounds good. Talk to you later, John.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Joining us on the program today is Worth Ray. He's the Chief Economist and Global Macro Strategist at STA Wealth Management. And Worth, when we last spoke to you earlier this year in January, you talked about the single most dangerous catalyst for a global financial crisis. And it looks like we were really on the edge of seeing another financial crisis at the time. Credit spreads were widening considerably. Financial market stress measures were ticking up very strongly. And we've definitely backed down from a lot of those risks. But it looks like we still are seeing some signs of deterioration in China. However, they have thrown in a massive amount of stimulus into their market, into their economy, to stave off probably these growing problems that are now widely recognized. If you wouldn't mind, bring our listeners up to speed on some of the global macro risks that you outlined in our last interview and what has taken place since.
Sure, Chris. Glad to do it. So the last time we spoke, I think back in January, the world, I think, was very close to going off the edge. I think we had, you know, as close of a call with a global financial crisis and a global recession as we did in 2012 with the European crisis. It was very, very close. I think it could have been worse than 2008. But, you know, the dollar then proceeded to peak out in late January. What looked like you're in a position where what you needed was the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan to significantly ramp up their easing programs. I think they were in the process of preparing such a move, and that could have gotten very ugly. Those were the big catalysts for a breakout in the dollar. I think that would have put so much pressure on China in terms of Chinese outflows that Beijing would have been rational to float the renminbi there, and it would have been a global shock. The other thing is that, you know, with the dollar getting very, very strong, both on, you know, competitive easing in Europe and Asia, and then also with the renminbi shock, the oil market and other commodities would have gotten, you know, so cheap and to very disruptive levels. I think that's exactly what you heard Janet Yellen, by the way, describe at her speech at the Economic Club of New York just a few weeks ago. She said China's exchange rate policy and oil were the two principal global risks. If those got very bad, then it could disrupt global growth. That could weigh on the U.S. economy.
Well, we almost got 11 weeks of an upside in the market, but since rising for about 10 weeks, the market has been rolling over. Is this a brief correction, or are we just in stall speed? Joining us on the program is Tom McClellan from the McClellan Report. Tom, what's your take on the S&P here? We really had a nice liftoff from the early part of February, and we got up over 2,100, but boy, we couldn't stay there very long, and we've been in a retreat ever since.
Well, trees don't grow to the sky all at once, and so a pullback just to restore a little bit of order was necessary and is a healthy thing. The rate of the advance that we saw off that February low and the strength of the breadth numbers that we saw, the advanced decline numbers, those things say that we are promised more upside movement once we get past this little consolidation that we've got to do here. For the moment, though, all the people that were following the sell in May and go away are feeling pretty proud of themselves after a week of down prices.
And Tom, as you follow this cycle work, as you mentioned, we had, 10 weeks of rising markets, and so we're pulling back. Nothing goes straight up because it was beginning to look parabolic had it continued in that trend. Typically, when we get to this time of the year, typically in May or the end of May, that old saying, sell in May, go away, what are the probabilities of that holding true this year?
Not very good. The whole idea of sell in May and go away works most of the time. It doesn't work in election years. So when people do that study and they look at what the return is from May to November and November to May, they don't do a good enough filter to see that, oh, hey, it's different in election years. And most of that difference occurs between about mid-May and mid-July, where there's a strong seasonal tendency in election years to go higher. So I'm expecting that we'll get a nice little oversold bottom here, get everybody complaining that election's going to ruin the stock market and we're all doomed and we all ought to just wait till November. And once we hear enough people muttering like that, then it'll be time for the market to do another leg higher. But we haven't achieved full muttering yet.
Well, I know that in June and July, we will have the conventions for both parties. Tom, is there any difference in the presidential election cycle in an election cycle where you have two new candidates versus, let's say, an existing president running for his second term? Is there any difference between those cycles?
Oh, there definitely is. Generally speaking, if you have a first-term president who takes off and is running for re-election, he'll typically try to get most of the bad stuff done and out of the way during the first 2 years of his first term. That way he can spend the last 2 years running victory laps and declaring victory for having solved all the problems. And so the generally upbeat nature of the news that comes out in an election year in that regard tends to buoy everyone's spirits, including investors. When you have a second-term president like we have now, he doesn't spend as much time declaring victory and saying, you ought to reelect me, because he can't get reelected. Plus, investors are confronted with the certainty that you're going to have somebody new. And even if the market could handle either of the somebodies that are new, not knowing gets everybody feeling anxious. And so we're going to likely go through a bunch of that until we get to about October. By October, we should know what the outcome is going to be, and people can start getting on with their lives again.
So given that, I do know that both parties last November busted the budget caps and restrictions, and I know that the fiscal deficit this year will be about $200 billion more than last year. So, you know, Congress is spending money and politicians want to get elected. What happens in an election cycle, Tom? So you think we could have a surprise coming into this summer? Maybe we'll have certainty. Certainly now we know who the two candidates are likely to be, maybe not the VP picks yet. What about as you get closer to an election when you got the party platforms? I mean, one party is saying, if you elect me, we're going to do this, more regulation, more taxation, and a bunch of stuff. Do you think the market starts paying more attention as we get closer to the election?
It will pay more attention because that'll be the only thing that's on television. Both of the parties will buy up all the ad time, so you won't be able to see any commercials for used cars or gold coins on TV. It'll dominate all the news, and so that'll be what everybody thinks about. And while the poll numbers typically go back and forth in between August and September, it should get pretty well solidified which way it's going to go by October. And once it looks like it's solidified, whichever way it's going to, either way, investors will start feeling like they can look past it and start looking at other things, and that'll be when the market should be able to start rallying again. But I don't expect that point of clarity to come to people until about October.
Let's talk about interest rates, because if you've seen the economic numbers, we've been in a declining trend since the middle of last year. Every quarter has produced lower GDP growth. I can't believe the Fed is still talking about raising interest rates. What's your take on interest rates here? Because we're looking at interest rates on the 10-year note at 1.75%, and we actually got down to 1.6%. So contrary to the thoughts of the market that we'd be seeing rising interest rates, Tom, we're seeing just the opposite. Interest rates have been in a very narrow trading range.
They have. And even if our U.S. economy starts roaring back again, there's a limit to how far the 10-year can go higher, because the equivalent duration bonds in Germany and Japan are still really, really low. And so it puts a kind of a leash on how far the U.S. rates can go before we start attracting a whole bunch of foreign money to knock those rates back down again. Generally speaking, for the next 4 or 5 years, I'm expecting low inflation rates and consequently low interest rates, but not static and not fixed interest rates. They're going to fluctuate around. One of the things that we're looking at right now and paying attention to is the commitment of traders data published by the CFTC every week is showing that the smart money, the commercial traders of treasury bond futures, are net short in a really big way. That means that the smart money thinks that bond prices are going to go down in the near term or yields higher, and that's on treasury bonds. The same data on the 10-year and on the ultra-long 30-year bond, those data don't really work that well. You can't get good correlations to what the price movements are, but on the 20-year treasury bond, that tends to work really well, and even for the other types of products, they seem to have the right message. Right now, the smart money is short in a big way, and they can be early, but they nearly always get proven right.
So, contrary to what the traditions are around this time of the year, even though we've had a pullback, as you mentioned earlier, the people that said sell in May look pretty smart right now, we're pulling back. But you think we could have a nice rally into the summer that would take people by surprise? It might be stimulus. It may be something favorably said by the Fed. Who knows what it is? But traditionally, this is what happens. Now, given that, and also that they think interest rates may rise, we could see a pop in economic growth from the anemic first quarter numbers. Tom, anything else that you're looking at? And let's talk about commodities for a minute. We've got oil pulling back, but it's still in the mid-40s. It's come a long way from the $26 prices that we saw early February. We've got gold, and I want you to spend some time on gold here, because we got gold near 1300, and we also have silver breaking out. So let's begin with commodities. What's your take on what you're seeing there?
Silver prices broke out to a higher high. Gold mining stocks broke out to a higher high. Gold prices did not. And that kind of divergence can go either way. You can look back in history and construct a set of circumstances to prove either way that the gold mining stocks know the real story or the gold bullion knows the real story. I'm looking at, again, the commercial traders of gold futures, and they are net short in a huge way right now, and they have ramped up their net short rapidly. They're pretty darn sure that gold has no business being up this high, and we're waiting for them to end up being right. I am not a believer in this gold rally now. I will be later this year. The 13.5-month cycle in gold that is dominant is topping now and heading down to a bottom due later this year, around November. So I would be much more interested in becoming an investor in gold around November than I am right now, because you have the cycle fighting against you and you have the smart money betting against you, and the smart money tends to be right about that. I'm fascinated that the current precious metal du jour that is of fascination in other markets is rebar, a reinforcing bar for concrete in China. That seems to have taken the place of copper as what people are stockpiling as the collectible metal. It's a fascinating story that Financial Times just did a story on it. You can search on it and find it and look under Chinese rebar, and it's amazing to see the price appreciation of that.
We've seen a lot of the commodities from copper, but yeah, I saw that story, which is amazing given this. Well, maybe part of it is China is using what they've always done to stimulate their economy, is spend money on infrastructure projects and expand credit, which they're doing now in a major way. But I want to come back to gold for a second, because if you take a look at, you know, we ran a chart of the XAU versus the price of gold and the divergence between the two of them, you'd have to go back for a long time to see something similar to this. So it looks like the gold stocks are very, very overstretched. Would you agree with that?
I would. And part of that is that Freeport-McMoRan is a part of the XAU. And Freeport has interests that are not just gold interests. It has some oil exposure and some natural gas exposure. So it has been benefiting, not just because of what gold has done, but also by the rebound in oil prices. and it's now started to have a little detriment. It had 11% drop earlier this week just because the premium was starting to come out of oil prices. In addition, I don't think that oil has as much upside left to go because we're seeing the big contango disappear. Several months ago, when we saw the near-month contract down in the 20s, the far-month contracts a year out were up in the high 30s, and you had a big spread. And so it made sense for a oil investor to buy spot market oil, store it in a tank, pay the storage costs, and sell a futures contract for a year from then and harvest the difference. That contango has disappeared. There's only about a 2 to 3 point difference in the near month contract versus year out. And so that says there's not as much upward pressure on oil prices as there was before.
Yeah, and also the storage costs, they're running out. I mean, if you could get a ship, it's cheaper, but you know, a lot of them are putting them on railroad cars, which can be very expensive. When you look at this market right now, and you expect this rally to surprise people, in other words, this could be a corrective stance here. What sectors look good? Is there anything that really stands out to you? I mean, we've seen a lot of the defensive sectors do well. Anything that says to you right now, from a chart point of view, this really stands out and looks like a place to put some money?
Generally speaking, as a philosophy, if you're in a long, steady uptrend, then paying attention to relative strength is good. You know, buy the leading sectors that are leading the way higher. Coming out of a bottom like I expect to see in the month of May, that rule doesn't work. When you're coming out of an oversold bottom or a correction like I'm expecting that we're in, the beaten down stocks that got beaten down during the corrections are the ones that come back the fastest during the rebound. So look at the new lows list. Look at the laggards among the high beta stocks, especially in among the NASDAQ 100 stocks, and look for them to have a more robust rebound than the rest of the market.
So if I was to sum this up, Tom, the smart money is expecting a bump in interest rates. That's where the commercials are. The smart money is also short gold. And so you'd be avoiding some of the commodity sectors. There's a limit on oil. So would you just sit on the sidelines and wait for this correction to bottom out? And if that's the case, what would be the signs that we've hit that bottom and it's time to put that money to work again?
Yes, wait for it to bottom out, but you shouldn't have to wait too long. In general, during a second-term presidential term, that bottom is due May 19th. Right now, the market is running a few days ahead of schedule, so I don't expect that we will have to wait even as long as May 19th. Probably about a week before then, it would be about right. So that puts you out to about May 12th, which is only a week from today. So I'm not looking for a whole lot more damage to this correction, but I am looking for more work to get done on investor sentiment and on the muttering of people about how the market's going to hell and the economy's going to hell and we're never going to see a Q2 GDP rebound and the Fed is wrong for, you know, once everybody starts muttering in unison like that about how this is just a horrible time and we should all get defensive and buy bunker in our backyard stocks. Once you start hearing that be the dominant theme of discussion in the financial media, you'll know that the bottom is at hand. You can also turn to other indicators like the McClellan Oscillator that we talk about in our daily edition and on our newsletter for looking for an oversold reading along about then. It's not quite oversold enough to be a juicy opportunity yet, but it's heading that way.
Tom, well, listen, as we close, speaking of your newsletter, how can our listeners find out more information about that?
Best way is to go to our website, which is mcoscillator.com. That's a contraction of McClellan Oscillator, the indicator that my parents developed. Have a lot of free information there. They can also find out about signing up for our subscription publications. We even have a free weekly chart and focus email that goes out to you. No strings attached, and we don't sell our mailing list to anybody, so you're not going to get spam by signing up with us. It's just a great way to find out more about the indicators that we follow.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
Approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining us on the program as my special guest is Rob Franek. He's Senior Vice President and Publisher of the Princeton Review. Rob, I want to begin with, you know, what the numbers are today, I hear that a private education like Harvard or Stanford can cost as much with room and board as much as $60,000, $70,000 a year. A private four-year degree could run in the neighborhood of anywhere from over $200,000 to as much as $280,000. Can you bring us up to date? What does it cost to go to a top 10 school like a Harvard or Stanford, you know, MIT? What does that run today?
I'm totally hearing the question, and it's one that comes up often from students, you know, coming into our Princeton Review channel. The numbers that we talk about, and we call it, Jim, total cost of attendance. This is tuition, room and board, fees, and books. And the total cost of attendance for 1 year of private college or university, average nationally, is a little over $41,000. But you're very right. So many of the schools that our students and so many students and parents are considering now might top the $50,000, $55,000, $65,000, $68,000 NYU in my home city of New York City this year. So they become heart-stoppingly expensive. But I do want students and parents to take some minor solace, at least, to understand that $41,000 is the average cost of attendance for 1 year of private school.
One of the big issues on the Hill this week is Puerto Rico. Is it going to be a bailout or a bail-in? Joining us to keep us up to date is Rob Bernard from PFS Group. Rob, give our listeners a little bit of a brief background on Puerto Rico and why the, let's say, Congress is thinking about possible bailout here. So give us just a brief rundown, if you would.
Well, remember, Jim, that Puerto Rico was invaded by the U.S. in 1898. And basically, our military remained in control till 1948. And basically, the first governor was elected in 1952, and our Congress approved Puerto Rico's constitution and made it a U.S. Commonwealth. And all the citizens there became American citizens. And so there it started.
I know that over the years, Congress has created various tax advantages. And I think, Rob, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you are a U.S. citizen, and let's say you live on the island at least 6 months out of the year, you don't pay any federal income taxes.
Well, that's right. But more importantly, Congress put together this U.S. tax section number 936, and they implemented that in 1976, and basically exempted U.S. corporations from having to pay federal tax. So Puerto Rico wound up becoming a true powerhouse with one of the biggest pharmacy clusters in the world and produced some 30,000 direct jobs and another 96,000 indirect jobs. And Jim, Puerto Rican economy was absolutely booming at that time. But as you know, all good things must come to an end. So if you fast forward 20 years, the U.S. government under President Clinton was looking for ways to balance the budget. And Section 936 was viewed too expensive, and guess what? They phased it out over 10 years, and that was when Puerto Rico really hit the skids. Soon after that, they full-on went into recession.
So did a lot of those companies, pharmaceutical companies, Rob, that were down there, did they leave? I mean, pack up and just say, oh, we're out of here, there's no more incentives?
Well, they had a brief incentive. Puerto Rico put in a tax, a 4% tax, and made it so that because it was a part-time tax with a finite end date, the IRS allowed it to be deducted against their Fed tax. Because remember, in 2006, the Fed tax exemption ended. And so Puerto Rico said, look, we got to, you know, charge you guys something. We're going to charge you 4%, but you can deduct it against your federal return. And so some of the bigs did stay there. They stayed there as long as they could before it became evident that, you know what, we can go to Ireland. We can go set up shop any other place. And so they started exiting. But to this day, I mean, there's still pharmaceutical companies still located in Puerto Rico because they wanted to be there because it's close proximity to the United States.
Yeah, this brings it up because I mean, there's commercials that you see on the financial channels of, you know, widows and orphans that are going to lose their retirement savings. They're running commercials. So bring us up to date. What's going on right now? What are the bankruptcy laws in a commonwealth compared to a state?
So right now, Puerto Rico wants to reorganize under Chapter 9. But as you know, the state's can get Chapter 9 reorganization. But since Puerto Rico is a commonwealth, it does not enjoy the Chapter 9 reorganization. And so therein lies the rub. And Puerto Rico got there by obviously losing all that talent, losing the tax-exempt status. And so now they are basically financing their deficit. They had very generous entitlements and very generous welfare checks. So over the period of the last 20 years or so, they have had to finance their deficits with municipal bonds. And it was okay. They were doing fine until, you know, probably 10 years ago when things started getting a little slippery. But in effect, what's going on right now is that you have different pieces of the pie. You've got hedge funds that own bonds. You've got mutual funds that hold bonds. And you have insurance companies that insure those bonds. And so right now, for example, you have the Republicans and Democrats trying to figure out a way to let Puerto Rico not default, per se, not walk away, not wipe the slate clean or a bailout, but they want to give them a different way to attend to their problems. So far, the Democrats want to afford some sort of restructure plan that allows some sort of a write down. The Republicans want to see, so far, undisclosed economic data to address Puerto Rico's root problems, and would want to install an oversight board to keep Puerto Rico honest with their pending reforms. So unfortunately, all the above are a non-starter for Puerto Rico. So here we are. This week, Puerto Rico defaulted on $420 million payment, which was supposed to be on Monday. And that, in effect, got everybody's attention before the big $2 billion payment, which is due on July 1st, 2016. So what we have is this big mass merging towards D-Day. So I imagine there's going to be lots of activity the last week of June of positioning for the hedge funds, the Congress, and the Puerto Rican governor. Now, keep in mind, Jim, that the Puerto Rico government is very generous. For example, their welfare checks are roughly $1,300 a month, and if you're working, you're going to get $1,200 a month. With those benefits, also produce food stamps. They also produce health care. I mean, they're very, very generous benefits. And in particular, the big rub that may be coming up the end of this month or beginning of, or I should say July 1st, is that these are general obligation bonds that will need to be paid, principal and interest, and they are to be paid first. They are to be paid before schools, before fire, before police, dog catchers, and welfare payments. And yet the governor is squawking about, hey, maybe I don't want to pay my general obligations first. Maybe I want to pay my population's welfare first. Maybe I don't want the police to go on strike. So he is really, you know, creating a lot of havoc in the bond world right now.
Rob, this almost sounds like some of the problems with Greece, where they were overly generous with their entitlements, and basically they were paying for it with borrowed money. And so originally, the first thing there was, some of those bonds got restructured, but a lot of government and political leaders are resistant to tell people, hey, the good times are over. We can't pay for all of this. Is any of that going on? Which is, it sounds like what the Republicans are saying, look, if we're going to bail you out, we want to make sure that, you know, you're sound financially in the future, that we're not going to be dealing with this problem down the road. So are there any attempts by Puerto Rico's government to reform?
They have shown some reforms, but not enough. Not enough to make the hedge funds happy, or the mutual funds, or Congress for that matter. He, in their opinion, still needs to make more reforms, still needs to do more cutting. And you're right about Greece. This is our Greece, basically. And therefore, he's been overly generous since the heydays between, you know, 1976 and 1996. Those were the heydays for Puerto Rico. They lived fat. People were totally employed. And the people that weren't received generous benefits because the Commonwealth was taking in huge sums of money. But Jim, look what's happening now. We've got roughly 3,000 people a week leaving in the past 5 to 6 years. 10% of the population has left on a yearly basis. And that's their productive people. That is their productive people have said, you know what? I'm out of here. I'm going to Florida. And they've all been finding jobs and doing just well. And because they're American citizens, they can travel at will throughout the entire United States or other territories.
So, Rob, let's put this sum up. What does this mean if I'm a Puerto Rican bondholder? You tell me they missed this one payment this week, and there's another $2 billion payment coming due July 1st. Should I be worried, or do you think there's going to be a bailout?
Well, it all depends, you know, what bonds you hold. These were the, like a government national bond, you might say, that was missed on Monday. It was their government bank bond, you might say. And so the ones coming due on July 1st is the Puerto Rican utility bond called PREPA, as well as general obligation bonds. And so we don't know enough yet. I mean, this is a very fluid situation that changes day by day as people air their views in the press. And so we're not sure if the governor's threats to stiff the bondholders come July 1st is real or not. We just don't know. It's a very fluid situation. As I said, we just have to wait and see if there will be a deal done. And if a deal gets done, Puerto Rican bondholders will probably take some sort of a haircut. Remember, the governor wanted a moratorium, meaning that he wants to have a interest-free period of up to 5 years, and he wanted everybody to take a hit of to the tune of maybe 60 cents on the dollar so that bondholders would wind up with a lower coupon, a moratorium for 5 years, and instead of having 100 bonds, they'd wind up with 40 bonds. Hedge funds will not have any part of that. Mutual funds will not have any part of that, nor will the bond insurers will have any part of that. So the negotiation now starts. So it's been talked about, well, maybe the bondholders will get 70 cents on the dollar for their bonds, a reduced coupon, an extended maturity, and a moratorium for 5 years of any interest. So, I mean, there's many, many different things being bantered about, but no one particular thing seems to stand out because, heck, we've got more than 30 days till that interest payment is due. So many, many different things can happen before then.
All right. Well, listen, Rob, I appreciate you coming on the program and bringing us up to date on this issue. And so right now, as you said, the situation is very fluid. Rob, if our listeners would like to contact you regarding investing in bonds, how could they do so?
Thanks, Jim. They can contact me at 888-486-3939 and just ask for me, Rob Bernard.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Well, since bottoming in early February at $26 a barrel, oil prices have spiked upward. A nice move in oil, but some are questioning, can this price hold, and have we hit a bottom? Joining me on the program is Robert Rapier. And Robert, let me throw some of the bearish arguments on oil to you. The IEA estimates that we may be producing anywhere from 1.5 to 1.9 million barrels of excess oil a day. A lot of that oil is going into storage. So we have a large amount of oil in storage today now. And they're saying with Iran now coming back into the oil market, being able to increase their oil production by 1 million barrels, that's essentially going to negate anything that is done on the U.S. side, which we're dropping our production here. And the other argument is we've seen anemic economic growth from the World Bank to the IMF, have been lowering global economic growth. China's economy is slowing down, one of the biggest consumers of oil. So those are the bearish arguments. And some would argue that the upward swing that we've seen in the price of oil has been more due to short covering. So if you could take each one of those and express your own views, whether those are valid points.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about oil is it rarely trades according to fundamentals in real time. I mean, investors are always looking down the road, and I think what's happened is people could see that the markets are going to balance later in the year. And all the bearish arguments that you stated are true, except I'll take exception to the one on Chinese demand. In fact, I just wrote an article this week that showed that, you know, quarter to quarter, if you look quarter to quarter, there's lots of times that Chinese demand will drop. But if you look at a rolling 12-month average, that's not the case at all. Demand is steadily increasing in China. So what you might see is 2-3 quarters of down demand and then a huge spike that'll bring demand back into the growth, the normal 12-month rolling average growth rate. So I think what's happening right now is, you know, everybody rushed to make sure that they didn't get left behind here. But right now, today, the fundamentals are still pretty bearish. It's just that if you look down the road 6-9 months, they start to look a lot better. But traders have always jumped in anticipation. They see that. They don't want to get left behind. So I think that's what's happening right now. I do think that the markets will start to come into balance. The demand is forecast to be up again, another 1.2 million barrels a day after being up. The IEA says 1.8 million last year. So you've still got strong global demand growth, but that 1.8, which was well above the average over the last 30 years, is forecast to be down to 1.2 this year. And a lot of people have spun that as slowing demand. And it's really just weaker demand growth relative to last year, but still stronger than the last 30 years.
So one of the things about the energy markets, and I guess this would relate to China, once you have a Chinese consumer go from a bicycle to a motor scooter to, let's say, an automobile, he has now become a permanent consumer of oil. So all those cars that have been sold in China, and China is now the largest car market in the world. So basically, is this what is increasing demand? Because China is importing more oil in 2015 than it did in 2014, even though their economy is slowing down. What about this year?
Yeah, I mean, it's forecast to be up again this year, and it may slow a little bit in China, and I've seen a lot of speculation that it will slow, but there are other countries. India is growing like crazy. They're going to fall right into where China was a few years ago, where China, you know, sucked up all the excess production in the world. India is poised to start doing that now, and so are a lot of the small Southeast Asian countries. They're growing very rapidly. Demand, if you look at every developing region in the world over the past 10 years, demand has grown at double digits in every one of those. The only place demand has actually declined are in the Western countries, in the OECD countries. The demand there has actually gone down, but our per capita demand was so high to begin with that that's sort of understandable. We've cut a little bit of the fat out. We've got a little bit more fuel efficient, but they're coming from a level of much, much lower demand. And so if you got a low per capita demand, but a whole lot of people, and they just increase it a little bit, it has a pretty big impact.
Now, what about storage levels? According to a recent report, Cushing is at 92% working capacity. The big inventory levels in a big port in Europe is at 70%. And then there's supposed to be a lot of oil resting on ships, because with the contango in the market, if you can buy oil, put it on a ship, lock in a futures contract, you can lock in a profit. So does this in many ways, Robert, cap the upward mobility of oil prices and keep it in that 40 to 50? Or, as the bears would argue, if the economy slips into a recession globally, whether it begins here in the U.S., Europe, or elsewhere, that we could see oil prices back down in the $20 level?
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see the $20 level again. I mean, it's really hard to say. You know, what is the right price for oil? What is the, you know, might it cap at 40 or 50, or might it cap at 60 or 30? It's hard to say where the right price is. So I always trade according to where I think a fundamentally sound price is. And, you know, the short-term variations in between, I don't get too concerned about those. I sort of look at where do I think global supply is going to meet global demand, and I try not to get too caught up in the short term. I mean, we could easily fall back down into the 30s or low 30s. I mean, I could see that happening based on fundamentals. Then there is a lot of oil in storage. There's a lot of oil on ships. We are coming into high demand season in the U.S., so I think you'll see those Cushing inventories start to come down, and you'll see a lot of the inventories pull down. And at the same time, you're going to see production in the U.S. continue to slide. And all those factors are going to end up balancing the market. I'm seeing more people call for a lot higher prices now. Of course, a lot of people just, you know, whichever direction oil prices are going, they add $10 or $20 on, and that's their prediction. And so I'm seeing people now predicting 60, 70. I even saw an $80 prediction by year end. When oil was falling, you saw the other extreme. You saw people competing to see who could make the lowest prediction. But I think ultimately fundamentals will win out. They just don't win out in real time.
Now, let's talk about one of the factors that helped to rally the market, and that was OPEC talking with, particularly Saudi Arabia, talking with Russia about limiting production or freezing it at current levels. And there's been this game of chicken, which basically began with Saudi Arabia. Hey, why would we cut our production to drive up the price when all we'll do is lose market share? American frackers will take it away or somebody else. So there hasn't been an incentive, but there's a game of chicken going on. At some point, even countries like Saudi Arabia may be able to produce oil cheaply, but they've gone through huge budget deficits with the drop of oil. They've gone through $100 billion of their oil reserves. They are thinking of tapping the market, the debt market, to balance their budget. They're even thinking of taking Aramco and selling part of it publicly. At what point do large producers, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Russia, are saying, you know what, look, Iran is not going to go along with this, but enough of us, if Saudi Arabia, Russia, and a couple others cut production by a million barrels, and U.S. frackers continue their CapEx spending cuts, eventually that would cause the oil markets to get back to a more reasonable level in terms of profitability. Because if you take a look at what's happened to the oil industry, even ExxonMobil lost its AAA rating, which was hard to believe. So even Exxon now is paying more in its corporate debt.
Yeah. And if you look at Aramco, you know, one thing about that, I think that would make that the most valuable company by far in the world. The Aramco valuation that they've estimated would be, I think, more than $2 trillion, which is
Wow.
An unbelievable valuation. Yeah, they were going to sell maybe less than 5% of it, which would have valued it at more than $2 trillion. And the OPEC's policy, what they decided a couple of years ago, only makes sense if they assume that U.S. shale production would have continued to grow for the next, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. In reality, I think if I've called it a $1 trillion error on their part, because I think all they had to do is across the board take about 5% of production off the market, and they would have balanced the markets, and we would have never seen oil probably go below $70 a barrel. But they're thinking long term, and they're thinking, all right, if we cut, then the shale guys are just going to step in, and we're going to have to cut again. And that would have probably been true. They would have probably had to cut a few times. And I've heard the argument. They said, you know, why would we, the low cost producer, why would we cut production? Well, because of the implications of what will happen if you don't. I mean, yes, it's true. It doesn't make sense for a low-cost producer to be the one forced out of the market, but it's not like that oil is going anywhere. You've still got that for future. And, you know, you start a price war, you always have to consider the implications that, you know, it may end up in a place that you didn't want it to end up. And I think that's what happened here. I think they vastly underestimated how far oil prices could fall. If you look at the comments in the months following their initial decision, I mean, some of them came out and said it was miscalculation. And I can tell you, they never dreamed that oil prices would fall all the way into the 20s. I think what they thought was they could force oil prices down to the 60s, and they were thinking the marginal shale producer is up in the $80-$90 range, and they could probably knock a million barrels a day off the market at 60 or maybe $50. They never dreamed that, you know, nearly 2 years later, they'd still be dealing with oil prices where they are now.
Yeah, because when you really look at OPEC, who can effectively really cut and make a difference? It would have to be somebody like Saudi Arabia. It'd have to be somebody like Russia that's producing 9 million barrels, Saudi Arabia 10 million barrels, because a lot of the other countries are really, really struggling, from Venezuela to Nigeria, where you have disruption problems due to terrorism and plus just piracy. I mean, who effectively can cut and make a difference? And it would have to be Saudi Arabia and Russia.
Yeah, I mean, the three largest players in the world are the U.S., Saudi, and Russia. And so, you know, the difference is in the U.S., it's many, many smaller producers. And so I've heard this argument before, the U.S. could be the swing producer. It doesn't really work that way. It's a very much more crude process in the U.S. of people having to go bankrupt and a little bit of production coming off here and there instead of in Saudi, it could be a unilateral, you know, we're just going to chop production by a million barrels a day. I mean, they have the ability to do that. Russia has a handful of very large producers. They could do that, although they're a little bit more, you know, publicly traded. That's another thing about Aramco. If you go out and trade publicly, you are going to open up your books and you're going to maybe we'll have a little bit more transparency into what their actual reserves are, but they also may not be able to get away with, the production. Like, we wouldn't dream of ExxonMobil going out and trying to cut production to balance the markets. ExxonMobil shareholders would scream bloody murder. And that's what will happen with Aramco if they decide we're going to go out and we're going to cut production for the future of the kingdom and to save that oil until it's worth more. You know, shareholders aren't going to be too happy about that. So it may change that dynamic up a little bit. But yes, you're right. I mean, there are very few players that could unilaterally go out and do it. You know, Russia is not quite unilateral, but Saudi Arabia could unilaterally do it. Nobody else really could go out and unilaterally cut production by enough to impact the world market. But, you know, OPEC still produces more than 40% of the world's oil. So cumulatively, I mean, it wouldn't take much of an across-the-board production cut to balance the markets. And I think we're headed that way now. I think if you saw oil take a turn back down and dip back down to the lower 30s, I think you'd probably see OPEC say, okay, enough is enough. We're going to go ahead and make an across-the-board production cut.
Yeah, because, I mean, everybody thought that the oil market would be cleared within a year. We're the second year into this, and we're still dealing with $40 oil, when 2 years ago it was over 100. And obviously, that's affected everybody's bottom line, from OPEC to companies here such as Exxon. Given this kind of market, where would you be putting money if you were to invest in energy?
Yeah, I think that's pretty easy, actually. And we rotated out of the refiners back in September. We said, look, with the risk of higher oil prices, that refiners are not where you want to be, because refiners get their margins eaten into. If you just saw ExxonMobil's profits, it's the refining segment that got hit. Valero's profits were down nearly 50%. The refiners get hammered whenever oil prices go up, because they can't quite keep the gas prices up, because people start becoming much more discriminating shoppers. I can tell you what's the value right now is natural gas, because natural gas at $2 a million BTUs has never stayed there for very long. If you look historically, over the past nearly 20 years, every time natural gas prices dipped below $2.50 a million BTUs, within a couple of years, it had more than doubled every time. And so the oil producers have already moved. I mean, many of the major oil producers have moved up 50 to 100% since the lows of February. Natural gas producers, not so much. And so if you look at the gas producers, I think that's where you're going to find the value. I think that's where, you know, a year, 2 years from now, we'll look back and go, yeah, that was obvious. Just as we'd look back now and say, of course, $20 oil wasn't sustainable, oil in the 20s. And that was dumb to think that it could. And that's exactly when we should have been buying.
You know, it's interesting, because there were a lot of companies, even including Exxon, which bought XTO for gas. As the price of oil was doing much better than the price of natural gas, a lot of companies started shifting a lot of their production and their new exploration towards oil. When you're looking at the natural gas field, where do you think are the best plays? And what kind of companies do you think have the biggest, I guess, number one, a solid balance sheet and free of a lot of debt? Because a lot of these companies, as you know, a lot of these frackers have so much debt that they're really stuck producing oil because they have to service their debt load.
Yeah, and you absolutely need to pay attention to the balance sheets of these companies. I mean, some of the best natural gas producers are some of the big guys in the Marcellus, EQT, Cabot Oil and Gas. Cabot just had some bad news that a pipeline that they have tried to get to the coast so they could get out of the Marcellus was just blocked in New York. And so that hit them a little bit, because people were expecting, you know, they're going to get better margins. But I'm looking at all the natural gas producers now, and they're all pretty much up across the board today. Rice Energy, Antero Resources, Chesapeake, of course. There's one that's got a pretty weak balance sheet, but it's also, it was left for dead back in February. I mean, I don't know if people realize the share price of that is, I think at this point, quadrupled since February. I mean, it's kind of crazy. But a lot of the Cabot Oil and Gas, EQTs, those guys are up, you know, 20-30% since the lows of February. And as natural gas prices recover, you're going to see a big move in some of those names.
All right. And if you were looking at the oil sector, would you primarily stick with the large cap stocks, you know, your Exxons, your Chevrons, or do you think some of the mid tiers look really good at this point?
I mean, I personally, I've got money in EOG Resources. I think they are the most well-run pure oil company in the country. I've also got money in ConocoPhillips from the time I worked for them, but I don't think they're as strong. I don't think their balance sheet looks as good as the EOG's does. But, you know, if you want to really play it safe, yeah, some of the big guys. But the problem is the refining sector there doesn't look too good. So I think where refining helped them, you know, outperform the pure oil guys last year, I think this year the refining segment is going to be a drag on those guys. So I think ExxonMobil and Chevron and Shell, I think some of those are going to underperform because the refining segment's going to drag them down.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, so if I could ask you one more question as we close, if given on the day we're speaking, oil prices are close to $45 a barrel, if you and I were having this conversation December 31st, what's your best guess where the price of oil will be?
I predicted that we would get to $60 this year. I still think that's possible. If, you will see inventory start to decline over the next, I mean, this is about when they peaked last year. They peaked within a couple of weeks of right now last year. You're going to see, as inventory start to pull down, you're going to see more conviction in people who believe that oil prices are going to continue to rise. So I think we've still got a pretty decent shot at moving on up into the $50, $60 range. So I expect that prices will move higher from here, although they may move down first. They may go back down into the 30s. But I think 2-3 months from now, you're going to see it clear that inventories are starting to come down and production is down in the U.S., which has gone up by more than any other region in the world over the last 5 years. So one of the big three, where I mentioned Saudi Arabia, Russia, and the U.S., one of the big three is going to have a major production cut just because of economics knocking some of these smaller and highly leveraged guys out of the market.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
Yeah, the easiest way is at Investing Daily. I write a couple of weekly columns, and these are free columns that anybody can read. And this week I addressed in the energy letter the issue of declining Chinese demand and that the myth of declining Chinese demand. You can also catch me at Forbes. I write a weekly column there at Forbes. And then I've got a subscription column at Investing Daily that's a biweekly column called The Energy Strategist. So those are the places people can find me most easily.
Well, the economic numbers don't look exactly tantalizing. Remember, in the second quarter of last year, 2015, the economy grew 3.9%, dropped to below 2% third quarter, below 1.4% in the fourth quarter, and 0.5% in first quarter of this year. The question is the economy hanging on the ragged edge of a stall? And if so, why is the market still having a certain level of enthusiasm going in there, especially considering that the jobs numbers out on Friday were not looking good either? And this is an election year, and economics determines which way oftentimes elections go. All of that subject of conversation coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.